Consequence Podcast Network.
This week on The Sidetrack, we'll spend time with author and journalist Melissa Mertz, who probably knows more than most of the civilized world about Richard Linklater's 1993 classic high school comedy, Dazed and Confused. We'll sit down, we'll get down, and we'll probably repeat Matthew McConaughey's famous line from the film about 27, 28, maybe 32 times. That's this week on The Sidetrack. You can probably count on one hand, maybe two, perhaps three, the number of films, ensemble comedies or dramas that started with a cast of unknowns and resulted in dozens of careers over the years. Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused is clearly one of those. If you look at the list of cast in that film, to date, a good portion of them are still performing and still making quite a bit of scratch at the end of the day. Well, today we're going to sit down with author and journalist Melissa Mertz, whose new book, All Right, All Right, All Right, The Oral History of Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, is out this month, November. November 17th, to be exact, for those living in a time capsule and revisiting this show 28,000 years in the future. Well, Melissa has quite a storied history of writing for music publications like Spin Magazine, like Rolling Stone. But if there is to be one significant milestone in my mind, and given this is before I've even sat down to talk with her, that Melissa will claim for thousands of years as her own unique accomplishment, it's that she tirelessly sat down with every single key cast member, including Richard Linklater from Dazed and Confused, in person, on the phone, the result of the crazy amount of research, which clearly I know nothing about on a weekly basis with this show, is a book that is the penultimate reference for one of the most, one of the most popular guilty pleasures from the 90s that exists. Now, if you haven't noticed already, there is one significant change that we're making to the format this week, and we will make this our new format on a go-forward basis, which is this. We will focus this particular episode on our interview with Melissa Mertz, and then the subsequent episode will include the standalone commentary of Dazed and Confused. That way, we can just keep things clean, you know, with our OCD of organizing different podcast episodes into different podcast categories. So, stay tuned. We're going to talk with Melissa Mertz. And then once you're done, you're going to want to download and queue up her commentary on Dazed and Confused, which is quite an Easter egg-laden experience. But for now, take a seat, take a load off, and enjoy my conversation with Melissa Mertz here on The Sidetrack. So here we are with author and journalist Melissa Mertz. I've just been schooled on the name. There is a T, but there's not a T.
There's not a T, but you said it perfectly the first time, and people I've known for a long time still can't pronounce it. So nice work.
It's good. Usually there's a silent letter in a name, but here there's no letter, but we're going to pretend it's there. So
yeah, you know what's sad is that the original version of my last name had an umlaut over the A, and that's so much more rock and roll. I wish my grandparents had kept it.
I think you should put the umlaut. That's actually, having an umlaut in your last name, I think, would be, like you say, rock and roll. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down with us today. I gave people kind of like the heads up at the start of this episode. I consider the amount of work that went into the research you did for this book to probably be, I mean, how many hours did you spend on this thing? It had to have been literally months of hours.
Yeah, so there's interviews with about 150 different people. But many of those people were interviewed multiple times, and many of those interviews lasted multiple hours. So it was a lot. I'm sad, you know, the original version of this book was about like 650 pages.
Wow.
It obviously can't be that long, but it hurts me to cut out some of the wonderful people who I interviewed who didn't end up in the book.
Okay, we're going to get to that, but I want to do a reverse in time for a second.
Yeah.
And talk about just your background. So you
sure.
Clearly music is something that is you hold dear, or else you wouldn't have spent all this time working as a journalist, a music journalist at places like Spin and Rolling Stone. Talk to me about where that came from for you.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it started, I randomly moved to Minneapolis after college for the dumbest possible reason. I think I had overheard somebody talking about how it was a really artistic but unpretentious place to live.
Minneapolis, okay.
Yeah, so I ended up moving there even though I didn't know anybody there and I didn't have a job, and just really got into the local music scene there. And ended up working for the Alt Weekly newspaper as a music editor there. That was my first kind of real professional job. And then this is a bizarre fact, but a lot of people who worked at Spin at the time, this is around, early 2000s,
okay.
Had come from that Alt Weekly paper in Minneapolis. It was called City Pages, still around. So I followed a few other music writers and went from City Pages to Spin.
So I'm going to say something that I think a lot of people can connect with. The only experience or knowledge I have of rock journalists is from what I know about Cameron Crowe. So Cameron Crowe to me lived this, I mean, you basically, you know, he wrote for, you know, his local Alt Weekly, whatever that may have been in San Diego. He eventually worked his way up to Rolling Stone. Now, given he was still, you know, 15 years old, but for all that I've seen in pop culture, that he's put out there with what that experience is like, you know, it's very romantic, right? You're on the road with artists, you're being pulled into this amazing rock and roll world. Like, is that real? Maybe it was real for him, but what was it for you?
I mean, yeah, there are definite elements of that. I mean, I got to go backstage at the Grand Ole Opry was amazing. That's one of my favorite experiences. I met Prince and got to interview Prince when he was still alive. Once found myself in a room interviewing both Paul McCartney and Oprah at the same time in conversation.
Wow.
So there is part of that, but you know, the parts I liked the most were interviewing people when they were still pretty young. I loved being able to interview musicians on their second album when they're just kind of starting, when people kind of are just starting to know who they are, I think is my favorite time to interview somebody. And that was often at Spin what we would be doing.
Now I think everybody when it comes to music, everybody loves to believe that they discovered a certain band. Like, you know, I remember being at the Viper Room and on Sunset seeing Matchbox 20 before their first album ever came out. And so I go around telling people, well, if it wasn't for me, like this is why, you know, Matchbox 20, right? Was there a particular artist or band that you heard early on, you championed them, you wrote an article about them and they exploded because of you, of course?
Definitely not because of me. Like, I can tell you a story. I'm notoriously terrible at this.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I know what I think is good, but I am terrible at predicting what's going to be popular. So when I was at Rolling Stone, they asked me, they had a, I think it was like a single that was out and they put it on my desk. My editor put it on my desk and he was like, listen to this and let me know if you think this is going to be big. And I listened to it and I was like, oh, this is terrible. It's so cliche. This woman is going nowhere. And that woman was Katy Perry. So obviously I know nothing.
Well, you know what? It's different medium, but when I first came to Hollywood, I was interning at New Line Cinema, and being an intern, they said, here, read some of these scripts. And they gave me a script called Menace to Society and said, you know, what do you think of this? And I read it and clearly I'm a Caucasian Jewish kid reading this urban genre film, not a genre film, but an urban film. And I was like, I don't get it. And they're like, well, we're starting to shoot next week. So Menace to Society for me, Katy Perry for you. both went on to be successful.
Wrong answer.
Yeah. Was Rolling Stone, well, you've also written for EW, like across those different publications, I mean, Rolling Stone continues to be one of the most revered publications. I mean, maybe not as much as it was in the through the 90s, but what was that? Was that a good experience? Like, what was that experience like, and how long were you working for those guys for?
Yeah, so I wasn't there very long. I was only there for 2 years.
Okay.
And I will say, like, the experience for me that was like an almost famous like experience was working for Spin. I mean, I loved working for Spin.
Yeah.
You know, we had a female editor in chief, which was basically unheard of at the time for a music magazine. I mean, there were very few, relatively few women at the time writing about music. And, you know, I got to write a cover story on the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, which was amazing. It just was the music that I was really into. Rolling Stone, I think, was a job I had wanted all my life. And the best part of that job was getting told I had the job. And everything after that was not as good.
Yeah.
I think it was just, it was a very hard place to work as a woman. I don't know if that's still true, but it kind of sucked. And I think for a long time, I'd come home every day being really bummed out and being like, you know, I like this job. And finally people started asking me like, do you really like this job? Or do you just feel like you should? And I think it really was the second. Spin was amazing. Spin was the experience that I imagined it would be and more.
Yeah. Well, just out of curiosity, and I, you know, however much you can say about it, but was the fact that you were a woman working at Rolling Stone, was it, was there a preference being given to male reporters? Was it just a, I mean, what, how did that manifest itself?
Oh my God, do you have 10 days for me?
I have 33 seconds. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give you one example.
Yeah.
So an editor there wanted to do a Women in Rock issue. And I've always been against Women in Rock issues for many reasons that are too long to get into. But mostly it's like you throw a bunch of women on the cover who have nothing to do with each other sonically and just pretend it's a thing just because they're women.
Right.
So I told him I didn't want to do it. And then he was like, okay, well, instead we're just going to do profiles of all these women we love. And I was like, great. So I did all of these interviews with all these different women. And then they took my reporting and gave it to a male reporter who has a name that could be, you could think was a woman.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote the whole thing with my reporting. I got no byline. And I think they still thought that people could think that a woman wrote it. Uh-huh. Nothing against this reporter. I don't think this reporter had any idea this
sure.
was going on.
Sure.
But that's just one of many, many examples. I mean, you know, Jan Wenner knew the interns' names and he didn't know my name. And I was a senior editor. Wow. And I think he just knew all the dudes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there's, I could get into a lot of stories, but I think that story is a
well,
prime
we'll,
example.
We'll keep Spin and that experience as the high watermark. Journalistic experience of your life. And
I think that's a real credit too to Saya Michael, who's now at the New York Times, because she was the editor in chief when I was there. She was great.
Sweet. All right. So all of this experience of interviewing people clearly set you up for, put you in a mindset for dazed and confused. And all. And I every time you say the title of the book, am I supposed to do it in Matthew's voice? I've done it once or twice already.
I'd like to hear you do it. Yeah.
All right. I mean, that's the best I can do. It's funny. I was doing research, not as much research as you did on this book, in sitting down with you, and I came across an audition, a Matthew McConaughey audition that he did for the movie. Man, he was young, but at the same time, like, you can just see the talent there, like his ability to play that role immediately in that test screening footage.
Well, and you know, what's so interesting about that is that Linklater thought he was wrong for the role when he first met him. And so many of the cast members say that too, that he seemed like just kind of a preppy frat boy who played golf, which he was.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that the person who seems, one of the people who seems most natural in that movie is actually doing the most acting.
And who's that?
McConaughey. I think he was becoming a person he wasn't in real life. And I think he was really modeling that role on his brother Pat.
So how do you make the decision? What is it about this movie that gives you the idea it's like a huge undertaking to even wrap your head around this. I mean, for folks who don't know about, I'm assuming, and because I've published some nonfiction books in the past, you pitch, you know, do you have an agent pitching this concept for you out there? Do you pitch HarperCollins directly? What's the origin of getting the green light from HarperCollins to go out there and do this?
Yeah, good question. So I wrote a proposal first, and before I even sent it to Harper through my agent, I sent it to Linklater, and I kind of cold emailed him like, wow, "Hey, I want to do this book. This is what I'm thinking this book will be." And the book is not really what I originally thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
But I sent it to him, and he wrote me back this really great email, which I still have. He was like, "Hey, first of all, I'm kind of sick of Dazed and Confused. I'm tired of talking about it. I hate that a lot of people think it's my best movie. I don't think it's my best movie. I think it's middling at best." And he kind of ranted about the movie. I think he has a bad feeling about the movie because of his experience making it, that he fought a lot with the studio.
Yeah.
But then toward the end of this email, he started to be like, "But have you read this thing about it? And did you check out this thing?" He was starting to throw me, research that I should be doing. So I was like, okay, I bet if I can prove myself to him, he will be involved. So then I pitched it to Harper and they greenlit it. And I think the more I interviewed Linklater, the more comfortable he got and the more he was able to be interviewed, the more he made himself available to be interviewed.
And is he the key that unlocks the door to everyone of the cast?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, he definitely helped get me Matthew McConaughey. But I think a lot of times it's just like you talk to one person and they're still close with another one of the actors. So they ask if it's okay to pass along a cell phone number. And you kind of, you know, walk this stepladder of proving to people, that you're not out to get them, that you're actually wanting to do research for this book. And you get people little by little. I think, it wasn't until the very end that Ben Affleck agreed and Renee Zellweger agreed. Linklater helped. And I think a lot of people, even if Linklater didn't ask them to participate, a lot of people did just because they still love him so much. And I think they want to be involved in something that he is supporting.
So you sit down multiple times with, I mean, if I run through the names, tell me, like, Matthew and Jason London, Mila Jovovich, Ben Affleck, Parker Posey, Adam Goldberg, Joey Lauren Adams, Anthony Rapp. I mean, those plus, to your point, 100 more?
Yeah.
Did you talk to, when you say 100 plus people, does this crew, is this, you know, extras, everybody?
Yeah, good question. So it's definitely crew. It's all the, not all the extras, it's some of the extras. A lot of the people that I had the most fun interviewing were Linklater's high school friends from Huntsville, Texas. And a lot of those people say that they were the inspiration behind certain characters in the movie. Some of them have the same names as characters in the movie. So that was the most fun. But I think I started to get to a level where I was tracking down all of these extras and somebody told me, you need to stop at a certain point.
Where does it end?
The further away people get from the movie, the less they're going to have to contribute. And I think that was right on.
So in sitting down with all of the key named cast, I said this earlier, it's amazing when you look at the list of folks in this movie and where they are today and the careers that they've had. But what was the most surprising interview for you? Who you imagined or your perception of who these actors were was completely different. What was a surprising moment or moments in interviewing some of these folks?
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is how many people generally cried.
Wow.
During these interviews.
Did Ben Affleck cry?
Ben Affleck did not cry. I mean, the surprising thing about Ben Affleck is that I had no idea how emotionally invested he still is in Dazed and Confused.
Wow.
Like, that was kind of a great moment. I mean, he says that he only has two movie posters in his house from movies that he has been in. And one is Argo, which obviously he won an Oscar for.
Sure.
And directed. The other one is Dazed and Confused.
Wow.
Which is a pretty big deal. I mean, he called it one of the most profound creative experiences of his life. And I think that goes back to why so many people cried during the interview. I think people still have a lot of very emotional feelings tied up in that movie.
Interesting. And what? So who cried the most? Who couldn't stop crying?
Can I out people? I mean, I don't know. People cry. I don't necessarily want to out who cried the most, but okay. People cried for different reasons.
Yeah.
Like, I think it was interesting to see some of the crew and some of the cast cry because they felt like that was the golden age and it's over.
Yeah.
That was a big theme for people crying. But some people cried for other reasons, you know, like Jason London had, I don't know how much I want to foreground this, but he lost somebody during that movie. And I think reliving that was a pretty sad thing for him too. Yeah. So, but mostly it's just incredible. The nostalgia that people have for making this movie is incredible.
What do you think in pulling all this information out of all these folks, is there something, I mean, people have written a lot about the conflict that Linklater had with Universal as he was shooting. You know, part of your commentary, which people I think are going to really enjoy, that's fascinating, is one of the pieces of information you have in there is that the cue, just the cost of It's Sweet Emotion, right? The opening of the movie is more than the budgets of his movies in the past. I mean, one song, some of that stuff's so fascinating, but was there something that you had not seen people write about that came out through interviews, whether it's a tidbit of information or something that was such a surprise about the making of the movie or a moment in behind the scenes that people would be super surprised about?
Oh my gosh, so many things. I think the fact that a lot of the stories people tell about this movie are about blurring the lines between the people who were mean in the movie and the people who were mean in real life. like, you know, some people think that Parker Posey and Joey Lauren Adams were mean in real life because, you know, they're mean in the movie. Same with Ben Affleck and Cole Hauser.
Right.
That was really interesting. I think I had no idea how autobiographical this movie was.
Oh, wow.
Like, I mean, obviously I knew it was based on Linklater's experience, but in the same way that everybody says this was a movie about their high school, but there are names, there are places, there are tidbit, there are words that people use in Huntsville that I've never heard people use before that are in the movie. Like the idea of a beer bust is, you know, we called them keggers.
Right, right.
It's something that came from Huntsville. And the more I talked to those people, the more I was like, wow, first of all, Richard Linklater has an amazing memory. He can tell you like the scores of baseball games that he played when he was in high school.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's part of it is that he was really, you know, taking notes and remembering these things as they were happening. So that was surprising to me. And the other thing is also that I think this book is really a portrait of indie filmmaking in the early 90s, that this was a very short period of time when studios were making these $6 million movies and picking up indie directors who so many of them had made their first films on credit cards, charged the whole film to a credit card. That's what Linklater did with Slacker. So I think that that was an interesting thing too, was that he had this experience that a lot of people tell me was kind of indicative of the way that indie film was going at that time.
So the book as it exists, so if I think about the Venn diagram of your commentary on the film, the book as it exists and that people can buy this month, and the amount of information that did not make it into the book. what does that look like? Like the commentary is 3% of the book. The book is 10% of the overall research. What's the math?
Well, so the book now I think is like 450 pages. Okay. The original version I submitted, I think was about 650 pages.
Wow.
I don't think any of my commentary covers the stuff that I cut from the book. And, you know, to be honest, the stuff I cut from the book is probably the stuff that should have been cut from the book. But most of what I cut...
You're a very well-adjusted journalist then.
Yeah. You know, they always say when you turn something in first, you should cut out 20%.
Right.
And I think that's very true.
Okay.
But I was just so attached to it. I mean, a lot of what was cut out of the book was this period between when Linklater graduated from high school and when he made Slacker, which was all about him forming the Austin Film Society, which is still around. But I find fascinating. I mean, this is the thing that was like, you know, a bunch of people on beanbag chairs watching like German movies from like decades ago at a time when you couldn't stream anything. You couldn't find this stuff in video stores.
Right.
And Linklater set this up and people like Wes Anderson were going to watch these movies. Terrence Malick, you know, went up to one of these Austin Film Society, one of the early Austin Film Society meetups. So it was hard to let that stuff go. But, yeah. You know, if you're really interested in it, maybe I'll find a way to get it out there. And then the other thing that I cut was there's a big part of this book that's about the relationships between the cast after Dazed was over.
Oh, interesting.
When they're kind of trying, they're struggling in Hollywood in the early years. There was a lot more about that. There was a lot more about their relationships and their friendships and the drama and who dated who and stuff like that. But I ended up whittling that way down.
All right, well, perhaps in the, when you go into your fifth printing, they'll release the addendum to the book and then you'll have your 600 page book.
Yes, exactly.
well, I really appreciate you taking the time. I think that, the commentary is super engaging and super interesting, and I think if people listen to that and they're huge fans of that, then my gosh, the book is like 20x what they're going to get from the commentary. But it's a unique opportunity to be able to get you to lend your voice to the film. So I just want to thank you for that, and can't wait to look at the book as well.
Well, thank you so much for letting me do this. This is my dream, Paul.
This is your dream.
To be able to monologue over the movie that I love. So
Well, good. Well, thank you so much. And for all who are listening, get that Dazed and Confused film queued up on your service of a preference, and then listen to Melissa Meritz walk you through every piece of information you didn't know you needed to know about Dazed and Confused. Thanks a lot, Melissa.
Thank you, Paul.
Dazed and Confused, a classic, said many people, including me. It is available for rent, purchase, stream on any, if not all, of your platforms that you're subscribed to right now. And I'm telling you, if you're like me, you at least have 9 or 11 of them active as we speak. I want to thank Melissa Meritz for joining us this week. Her new book, All Right, All Right, All Right, The Oral History of Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, from HarperCollins, on shelves or digital shelves on November 17th. And finally, I want to thank all of our listeners who participated in our All Right, All Right, All Right sweepstakes, who walked away with their own first edition copy of the book. And I gotta say, while the book is a War and Peace sized reading experience in a super positive way, the commentary just complements what you're gonna read in the book. So get the movie, finish this episode, and load up the next one with Melissa Meritz doing her feature-length audio commentary for Dazed and Confused. This is Paul Davidson saying thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next week on The Sidetrack.